Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Timber Living Log Cabins. For your perfect workspace, living space or hideaway, timberliving.ie. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Timber Living Log Cabins. Open your mind to a new way of living. timberliving.ie.
Good morning, you're very welcome to the show. Lots going on today, so let's start with a look at the front pages of the papers. The Sunday Times, Mac Hansen there, resplendent, going across the line. I think he nearly went across two lines there, but scored that try for Ireland in that thriller last night. Their lead story is McEntee backs hands-off policing of the far right, which is probably not as black and white as that, but we'll come back to that. But there are quotes from her in that story there. I think another story that is not as black and white as people might have initially thought either is the Temple Street Children's Hospital spinal surgery story. So the Sunday Independent, Maeve Sheehan has a lead story there. Surgeon sourced unlicensed springs for €51 a box. And she also has a very interesting big read on that inside. And we'll come back to that also. The Business Post leading with McGrath rejects $1.5 billion EU demand, right? And this is Daniel Murray. And we have the writer of the story here, so he might explain it to us more in a while. But isn't it gas? I think Irish people still kind of have this. We have this deep cultural thing that the EU, the EEC as it used to be, gives us stuff, and that we didn't realise that at some point there, I think we became a net contributor. And now it seems that the EU have come up with trying to come up with a new ways to get more money out of us based on our corporate tax take. The Irish Mail on Sunday is leading with a bombshell cabinet memo, they say, reveals that inflation has eaten 60% of the National Development Plan budget. So there's now a $14 billion hole in it, and this is of course for new roads and railways and Metro North and things like that. The Mirror, an insult to our Vicky's memory, and that is Vicky Phelan's dad, who is slamming the fact that hit out at the government over the lack of progress on cervical screening. The Sunday World is leading with a story about the murder victim Daniel McInaspy, and the Sun on Sunday is claiming that Strictly stars, this is the stars of, is it called Strictly Come Dancing or Strictly Ballroom, Strictly stars anyway, are demanding that producers call a Ghostbuster as they're convinced the studio is haunted. So our panel today, Professor Ronan Collins is a consultant in geriatric and stroke medicine at Tally University Hospital. Brenda Power is a columnist with the Irish Daily Mail and the Sunday Times. Hazel Chew is a Green Party councillor. And Daniel Murray is a political correspondent for the Business Post. Good morning, everybody. You're welcome.
Morning, Brenda. Morning. Morning.
If you put on your headphones first, and let's go to Paris now and reflect on a historic sporting evening. Donal Lenihan, good morning.
How are we doing, Brendan?
Donal, what a night, and the intensity of it. You were in the commentary box, and I'd say you must have felt like you put in a shift against the Springboks yourself, did you?
Yeah, certainly did. It was a massively emotional occasion. The build-up to this has been going on, if you like, for 3 months. But just the presence of so many Irish fans. Obviously, I've been working my way up from Bordeaux and Nantes for over the last 2 weeks. And the number of Irish fans out here is incredible. But Paris on Saturday morning was a sea of green. Because of issues around ticketing, people have been in the stadium about 2 hours before the match. So the atmosphere in the stadium was incredible. But the performance, even more special on a fantastic night for Irish rugby. The only downside is you don't get any cup at the end of it.
Yeah, yeah. But again, no, we could be, I presume we could see that same match in the final, could we?
Absolutely. I think if you're going on form at the moment and you go the way the draw is going to work out, I think there's every chance that you could see these two together again. But I think, you know, both sides will have learned a huge amount. I mean, Ireland struggled for long periods in the first half. I mean, it was an incredible show of resilience and fortitude that they managed to get to half-time leading. So, you know, there's scope for improvement within the Irish setup as well. But, you know, what a way to announce your best performance in a long time in terms of beating the reigning world champions.
Yeah, and I presume as well, like, that no harm to have that shaky start and to have to tough it out, because I suppose it's easy if the momentum is with you all the time, but to have to come back from that, regather and stuff, that's what shows the real grit and character, isn't it?
It is, but that's exactly what Andy Farrell has been trying to engender in the squad for the past 2 years. I mean, he brought 42 players to New Zealand on a five-match tour 18 months ago, and, you know, they lost the opening two games of that tour, yet they bounced back to beat New Zealand in a series. So, you know, he's been preparing for nights like that without getting too technical. The line-out is a huge part of Ireland's game, and when Ireland lost the opening four line-outs of the match, you could almost feel the collective groans in the stadium. So much so, I think Peter Armani finally won a line-out Ireland's fifth, and the whole crowd stood up and applauded. So, you know, it was one of those nights where you just had to find another way to eke out a win.
Yeah, and come here, not to get too technical, but that, like, I think that was very noticeable about the line-out. What was going on there? Was that just scrappiness, nerves, what?
No, a collection of a lot of things. South Africa have the best defensive line in the game. Plus, it helps when you have about four fellas standing between 6 foot 7 and 6 foot 11. You also, I think, which was a factor, your two Munster second rows in RG Snyman and John Klein were part of the Ireland, are part of the South African squad. Both of them came on in the second half. So I think they'd have a lot of insight knowledge. They train with the likes of Peter Armani and Tyke Byrne every day of the week down in Limerick.
Yeah.
You know, there was a bit of inside information there, but look, I think Ireland will learn from that and be better for the experience.
Yeah, and listen, Ireland probably do with their week off now, or the kind of 2 weeks to the next game. Like, it was an intensely physical game, as we knew it would be, wasn't it?
Well, you had to be there, really, to sense the physicality of it. You could almost hear the clashes despite 80,000 people in the stadium.
Yeah.
In terms of the, you know, we're in a horrible draw in terms of the way we have a very strong pool and the harder side in terms of the quarterfinals. But the one decent draw we've had is, you know, we've been able to build our way into the tournament with Romania and Tonga first. And having 2 weeks off now after that South African game could not be better timed, because they'll need 10 days to recover from a game like that. So hopefully, I know a lot of the players' families are out there getting a couple of days off. They can leave camp for 2 or 3 days and just relax and start gearing up for the Scotland game from Monday week.
Who stood out for you last night, Donal?
Oh, there was several. You go into the front row alone. Andrew Porter played 74 minutes in the front row. And given, as you know, all the talk about the bomb squad, South Africa bringing on 7 forwards in the second half, for him to last up until the last 6 minutes of the game. Caitlin Doris again was outstanding. Johnny Sexton, 38 years of age. I mean, the punishment he took, he was clearly going to be targeted. At one stage, we thought he was gone. He took a bad stinger to the shoulder. Yet, he found a way back. I was watching him looking at the clock, 65, 66 minutes. He was cramping up badly off camera. So there was no way he was going to hit the 80 minutes. But, you know, brilliant to see a young Jack Crowley coming in. It wasn't even in the thoughts of Andy Farrell 12 months ago. You know, had the wherewithal to attempt a drop goal, even though it didn't come off with about 8 minutes to go. But Sexton is the spiritual leader of this side. He just never takes a backward step. There's a connection now with the crowd. He came out again 50 minutes before the game for a warm-up, and he's doing a lap in the field. And all the Irish fans, the minute they saw him, they stood up and clapped. And Johnny turned around and he clapped them back. You'd never see that type of interaction from Sexton before.
Yeah.
You know, he's on his last legs.
Yeah.
He's due to retire at the end of the World Cup, and you can see he's savouring every moment of this experience.
Yeah, and look, I think everyone is savouring it. It's a fantastic time. Let's hope it stays fine for us. Donal Lenihan, thank you very much.
Cheers, Brendan.
Thanks, Donal. Were we all watching the rugby last night?
Yeah, certainly was.
Yeah.
We had a group over to the house last night to watch it, and it was an extraordinary game, and there was an extraordinary atmosphere around it. I mean, despite it not being a quarter, a semi-final or a final, it felt like it could have been one of those. And I think the two things going into the game were if we could win and if we could have as few injuries as possible, then it would give us the momentum for the rest of the tournament. And I think we've managed to achieve both of those things.
Yeah, Ronan?
Yeah, as everyone kind of gulps at home and says, what does this guy know about rugby? But the interesting thing I did take from the match was, number one, the tremendous fortitude, as Donal described, when we were under the cosh that we managed to get to half-time in the lead. But I was also very impressed how we can transition from experienced people to new talent, and that new talent has the bravery to take on things. So you see Jack Crowley come on and replace Johnny Sexton and have the bravery to go for it. And also we had the ability to bring on the experience of Conor Murray, who was very instrumental in the final minutes of that game and kind of turning over balls. So the fact that we have that depth transition between youth and experience is fantastic to see.
Yeah, no, you weren't at the match. You were at the other match yesterday, Ronan.
Well, I was down the Aviv as well because, you know, first of all, I didn't get the lucky opportunity to go to Paris, but there was a historic occasion down the Aviva, you know, to see more than 35,000 people at a women's senior football game was amazing. And the atmosphere as well, given that it was the first meeting, I believe, between the Republic and the North of Ireland, a very different atmosphere that you would find maybe at the male version of that game, which was also heartening to see. You know, the crowd mixing, enjoying the occasion. And you actually even see it on the sport, on the field. I've watched a lot of men's soccer and women's soccer because I attend the FAI games quite regularly. And the one thing you notice is that the women tend to play the ball on merit more. There's less diving, there's less cynical rolling around the place, looking for frees, looking for unfair advantages. They tend to,
Is that a more authentic kind of game?
I honestly could count the amount of fouls in the first half of that game in one hand.
Okay. All right, look, we'll move on to other matters of state. Brenda, do you want to kick us off on the Children's Hospital Ireland story, which is I feel the families themselves have said we're getting information in dribs and drabs. This story is only really revealing itself as we go along, and I think a lot more insight on it today. You had picked Maeve Sheehan's piece in
the Sunday Independent. Really explains, I suppose, to those of us who weren't up to speed with what exactly happened here in a very clear way. I think it is important to say, Brendan, that there's no suggestion, as far as I can see, of anything other than the best will in the world to try to address what was wrong with these children, this horrendous condition of spina bifida and scoliosis in particular, which causes a curvature of the spine which crushes the internal organs and particularly the respiratory system. And the difficulty seems to have been all along in treating this, that the way it is treated is a rod is implanted in the spine to straighten it. But the difficulty being that this obviously was a condition or at least an approach that required repeated surgeries because the children outgrew the rod. And this system was devised, I think it was Utrecht University, to implant a spring, which would suggest, you know, a more sort of flexible, literally, approach to the growth spurts. And this doctor, who's now been named in the papers this morning, Dr. He had been studying this. He had discussed it. It's not like he was a maverick or went off on a sort of a folly of his own. It was discussed and it was, you know, really investigated the possibility.
That's what it seems to say in Maeve Sheehan's piece. That's what Maeve is saying. He had discussed it with colleagues and managers there as well in meetings.
And you see, you know.
But then I think there might be a question as well where that it was sourced, assumed yeah. that he had clearance to use this. He's the surgeon. He's the expert that the clearance would come from the
Well, that's correct, but I mean, it seems also from Maeve's piece that the process of clearing and regulating these devices is not entirely clear either, and that it is up to the clinicians and the consultants and the surgeons to discover these devices and then look for clearance for them. You know, the point is, Brendan, I think that all surgery and all medical breakthroughs begin as experimental surgery.
There's a colleague, a source in that story, says actually this was not experimental. Mm. That this is something that was being tried out, and Utrecht, I think, were trying it out. But I think there might be a question about the nature of devices, the springs and what they were made of. Hazel, I'll bring you in a second, but I just want to ask Ronan, as the medical person here today. No, we're seeing a lot more now about what actually happened here today. What's your reading? You know hospitals, you know how they work. What's your read on what's going on here?
Well, When I first heard of the story without knowing any of the facts, and I don't know the surgeon involved either, obviously he's named now, and I think we should leave the name out, but there's often a series of victims in incidents like this. And my first thoughts, obviously, for the children, some of whom may have been inadvertently, if I could use that term, damaged or hurt by what has happened. All medicine does need innovation. It does need creativity. I think Tony O'Brien, in his opinion piece in Independent, you know, made that point also, that we don't want to suppress creativity.
And is innovation. This how it tends to happen?
Well, this is the issue.
Yeah.
There's a similarity between this and, dare I mention it, as a step out on the thin ice of the cervical check issue, about how we go about research and audit within the medical community. And there's no doubt, as Brenda alluded to, that the surgeon was trying to help the parents and the children who were in a very difficult situation. This is very difficult, complex cases. And very often there isn't an existing solution. And you try and find a solution very often at the pleadings of parents whose child is in extreme distress. And
so
you can understand that.
Bespoke solutions sometimes looked for in these situations.
There is. And this
bespoke
isn't.
Bespoke implants and stuff like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, but so this isn't completely just picked out of off the shelf, so to speak, that there was an existing body of research done looking at the spring technology. The issue arises, however, if you are using a technique that's not licensed, and this could apply to medicine, to using a medicine as well. If you're a user, and you know, there have been cases, for example, there's been fast-track approval of medicines as well in humane cases. You know, for example, the early
this is what we call off-market use of a medicine.
Pre-approval of medications.
Okay.
So, for example, the HIV drugs would have been a very good example where they were very much fast-tracked as well because we had a crisis. And even some of the COVID vaccines would have been treated very generously similarly. So sometimes there's a case where you have to advance the approval and the regulation. But the underpinning and the similarity between, as I said, the previous cervical check issue is that about audit and research, this must go before an ethics committee. Mm-hmm. An ethics committee must approve what you're planning to do. If it doesn't exist within your normal regulatory kind of situation. Now, there is always a situation, for example, particularly with orthopaedic surgeons or other surgeons where they go into a trauma case, for example, and they're in a crisis situation once they open up and they see what's in front of them. And many of these doctors have to think on their feet and be innovative, creative, and actually have to try a new technique, or they're aware of a technique that may have been tried and they will do something in an emergency situation. But in a situation where it's planned, and I think this is at the heart of the matter in a lot of the articles, the focus really will be on what kind of ethical approval did this go through.
So was there a process there seems
because they were using what would have been an unlicensed device.
Yeah, and so it seems to be a suggestion that it was not made from medical grade titanium and medical grade.
That's a suggestion. Yeah. I'm not going to comment on that. I don't know.
Okay, Hazel.
I think when we look at this, we need to look at what happens next. So Ronan had pointed to cervical check and check and
let's not
the issue.
No. Too much.
Well, yeah. What I'm trying to say is let's not confuse it, but let's look at the learnings from that and what we can apply here in terms of transparency and next steps. So next steps of how do we make sure we build patient and parent trust back. And that's a huge issue that's lost through this. And we need to make sure that the next steps are very clear on
what
we
do.
So do
you think that, because I think a lot of people are a bit confused as to what the broader consequences of this are for the hundreds of families who are involved in this, because it seems to revolve around a very small number of cases.
Yeah.
So what you're saying is that this is possibly a ring-fence situation on a small number of cases, but that it has damaged the broader trust with this community of parents.
It has. And I think you read it in various articles of parents commenting and the group that's representing the parents as well, that we need to bring them along and to make sure that they feel that they're getting the care that their children will need into the future. And that's the important learning here from all of this. While the investigations and the council and everything else is going on, I will be very concerned on how we bring the parental groups and the patients along. So.
Yeah, I think the best way to bring them along would possibly be to get their children the operations.
Yes, the care that they need.
In a timely fashion, even in the 4 months that the state has promised. Daniel.
Yeah, Brendan, there's a narrative emerging of because this is centered around a single consultant of individual failure. But really, you can't have that level of individual failure without some level of systems failure. And I think that's what these reviews are going to have to look at. As was being mentioned there, you know, the clinical governance issue, the ethics committees, how were these decisions made at a systems level? Because especially when you're implementing innovative techniques in surgery, you would imagine that means a higher level of clinical governance as opposed to lower. And okay. I suspect that's what we're reviewing.
So that is what there's the broader issue here. And parents, a lot of parents seem to speak very highly of this man who was apparently an extraordinary Absolutely. Advocate for their children and who went to extraordinary lengths to try and give their children the care they need and was clearly working very hard and everything as well. But that say we put aside the individual issue of him, what's coming across here is that there's a broader issue here run on of the processes, the clinical governance, the management was clearly not in place.
Yeah, absolutely. First of all, I think, you know, the crawler, the other side of this is many parents writing in saying what a fabulous surgeon this man has been for their children, how he's gone the extra mile to try and help them in very difficult situations. So there's no doubting that this man, and there's also a danger. If surgeons don't take on difficult cases, or we create the environment where people are seen to be punished, or it's a punitive environment to be in. I saw this.
Does it tend to be particular surgeons who deal with more challenging cases?
So I was interested. I was chatting.
Like, are we taking it away from this individual? Well, in general, is this how it works?
Well, it's interesting. When they introduced, if you like, the league tables in the NHS of mortality and infection rates, etc., etc., a lot of surgeons then started focusing on their case mix and saying, oh, hang on a second, I'm not going to do that. I would actually deny surgery because they would see it would affect, they could see that the outcome had a higher chance of being a poorer outcome. And you don't want that. You know, I'm a geriatrician, so I would have often been advocating for some of my patients, you know, please, you know, attempt to do the surgery here because I don't see an alternative. And you don't want to create an environment where the surgeon says, listen, that's just too high risk.
And presumably that's a similar situation where this surgery is complicated, high risk.
Very complicated and high risk. And, you know, so as you asked me initially, there was two ways of dealing with this in the NHS. One surgeon told me we had a guy who was kind of known as the guy who could take it, so to speak. He would deal with a lot of the complex cases. He would accept that his outcomes wouldn't look as good, but there was an understanding that he was dealing with a very high complex risk. And this is where your analysis needs to factor in what the standard mortality ratio is, what the standard infection ratio is, based on the complex mix of the cases. The other kind of like alternative strategy to do this is that you sprinkle the complex cases amongst the body of the surgeons, so they all end up with a kind of a levelling. But what you do not want to happen is that you do not want people not getting access to surgery. And, you know, there's an article in the Times by Julianne Corr, what the corollary of this is what Hazel is alluding to, is that a woman is now worrying about her son who's in pain constantly and who can see the operation being pushed down the line while this is all going on. But going back to your initial comment, I think we need to tidy up a little bit about the ethics and the regulation, and also that
is
resourcing.
I'm sorry, no, I'm focusing on run on a bit, guys.
Because, sorry.
You might be able to give us some clarity on how these things work. Are there ethics committees in hospitals who people bring before them?
Yes,
I'm
absolutely.
Thinking of doing this.
Absolutely. And, you know, the medical council would have a view as well, and that we have, you know, we have our own regulations to operate within. But, you know, we cannot conduct research and a lot of audit as well. You're better off going before an ethics committee because there can be corollaries of audit that you won't anticipate.
Corollaries of audit?
There may be implications that arise from the audit that you won't have foreseen. And one of the reasons you go before an ethics committee is that you get a peer review. You get many heads. And one of the things...
Yeah, and again, it does seem this was discussed.
We don't know how it was discussed, though, because, you know, one of the things that comes out among the articles as the last comment on this is about the importance of multidisciplinary working. When you were dealing with complex cases, everybody should try and realise that these are very complex situations. There may not be a single right answer, but you're more likely to find an answer that's a good one if you've many heads looking at it.
Hazel, so there's this. We saw the head of the HSE on the news the other night saying the extraordinary thing that, look, we want to assure people that this was around the Emily case. We want to assure people that it's not necessarily true that all of the residents in this place in this period of time were abused, right? He had to reassure people of that. It was shocking. We've had CAMHS recently. Like, it feels like the health service is springing leaks all over the place, like, and that there seems to be an element of minor chaos in various areas of it.
And this comes back to Daniel's point about governance, about structure, about this isn't the first time. So, and I know we're not drawing correlations with others as much, but it's more, is there a pattern here now? And are there systemic issues that we need to fix? And as we go into the next budget and where the HSE is going to be asking for more money, we need to see what are the issues that will create actual change in it that makes it work better. Because right now, it doesn't seem to be functioning well, and to your point, chaos. So, which is not good for the patients at the end of the day that come through.
As a last point, Brendan, just to say...
Yeah, this, briefly, Ronan, if you would. Yeah.
Ethics and approval needs resourcing. There's a delay in getting approval sometimes as well before ethics committees. And to drive research and innovation, you have to resource ethics committees and approval systems so that they can respond in a timely manner. And there's a huge under-resourcing. I've been on an ethics committee for many years, and there's huge under-resourcing. It's relying on grace and favour of people. Mm-hmm. And it's a very responsible job.
Okay. Daniel Murray, the... Scenes at Leinster House during the week. You've picked, we picked a number of stories here, but John Mooney's piece on the front page of Sunday Times. First, were you there?
I was. I arrived early enough. Was it Wednesday? I think it was Wednesday morning down to Leinster House. It was actually quiet enough when I was arriving. There was some protesters there and the barriers were up, but I didn't have any trouble going in. But later in the day, I was coming in and out of the front of Leinster House, and things had gotten really nasty and quite sinister. And I mean, anybody who was going in and out was getting abuse levelled at them, including me and a lot of my other media colleagues as well.
So they knew you were the media. They knew who was the media.
I was kind of near a group of cameramen, and I think that's why they presumed that we were media.
So mainstream media, you're part of the...
We are part of the problem, yeah. According to some of the slogans that were being shouted. You know, we're criminals, we're not telling people the real truth, and this kind of conspiratorial thread that went through the various things that were apparently being protested. But, you know, what was amusing maybe earlier in the day became more sinister as the day went on, and we've all seen the videos of Michael Healy being attacked and others.
We're not going to mention specific actions that were done. It's probably problematic in terms of the charges being brought and everything. So
sure, but just the sinister nature of them. And Shauna Farrell, who's the chair of the Dáil and is really the kind of head honcho down there, you know, he has spoken about how it was an attack on democracy and how it was akin to the storming of the Capitol over in the US. Now, while it may be slightly outlandish to compare those two things in terms of the scale of them, he is right in terms of the kind of conspiratorial underpinning of both protests.
And did it feel to you there as a witness, did it feel that some Rubicon has been crossed here?
It did feel like a moment outside the Dáil. I do have to say the gallows in particular and some of the more ugly scenes later in the day, it certainly seems to have galvanised the political system and the justice system to want to do something about it, which is maybe a shame when these kind of protests have been happening around the country, you know, focused on minorities and other individuals over the last year or so and going back even further than that. But there's a sense that the political system now wants to make a change. Now, what the nature of that change is, I don't know. There's the immediate policing issue, which is dealt with on the front page of the Sunday Times today. But then maybe the more difficult issue, which is, you know, how to address the nature of these groups, the nature of conspiracy and people who believe in conspiracy. And that's a much more difficult issue to untangle, I think.
Yeah. Brenda.
Well, I mean, you're entitled to believe what you want to believe. You want to believe in a conspiracy theory. If you want to subscribe to QAnon or whatever, you're perfectly entitled to do so. What you are not entitled to do, and I know you don't want to talk about the specifics of what were witnessed, but what you're not entitled to do is assault people going about their business. And, you know, this, I see the Sunday Times is saying, well, it's important we don't overreact. At least that's the thrust that the Gardaí were correct in a sort of a hands-off approach. But I mean, Gardaí policing is meant to be without fear or favour. And if you see somebody being assaulted in a way that would not be permitted by any other citizen in any other circumstance, then when that there is no arrest being made or no apparent attempt to prevent that, then you're talking about fear or you're talking about favour.
There were arrests made ultimately.
There were arrests made, Brendan.
Later in the day, I think.
Yeah, I know there were. But the question is, you know, do you have a hands-off approach on the basis that the objective of these groups is to provoke and is to create martyrs? If you don't do it this time, then what will they need to do next time to get the reaction that they want? And there's a really good piece by Declan Power in the, I think it's page 4 of the Sunday Times, talking about provocative weakness, that, you know, if you do take a supine approach, that you are going to end up with you know, escalated attempts next time to provoke. So, I mean, I don't know what the answer is, but I mean, I think...
Well, Declan Power talks about a thing called kettling there,
yeah,
which is apparently, I think he saw it in...
Corralling
in
the numbers. Yeah,
in Africa,
yeah,
which is that you don't baton charge them, but you've such a number of police there that you basically can kind of cordon them off into an area. Yeah. So maybe that you don't have that confrontation that they want for their phone videos, but that you just, in a calm way...
Quietly corral them. Yeah, absolutely.
There clearly are techniques for this kind of thing. Yeah.
A corral.
Hazel, you have probably longer experience of all this than most of the politicians do and than most people do.
Just by a few years at this stage. When I first got elected in 2019, within like months, there were threats. There were things coming through the door. There were things going online.
Of your house?
Of my house.
What kind of things, Hazel?
Just that they know where to find me, that they know where to find my child. And a member of An Garda Síochána Síochána had to come from Tala, from the security branch there, to actually check our house at the time. And it was a different house, thankfully, at the time. So,
how does that feel to live like that?
It's scary as hell, I can tell you. So not for just yourself, but for your child, because you have a child and you worry about them. And in my case, she looks exactly like me. She doesn't look like her father at all. And my worry is for her. But to the point of that Wednesday, what struck me was, apart from the anger and the nervousness, was that this just felt like a repeat. Like for me, definitely, and for others, many others, we have seen this scene before, not in this exact way, not with the mock gallows and the pictures, but similar for years. And especially in the last year, with the build up, with the burning of proposed direct provision locations, this has been a rising threat that we have continually ignored. And it is now at a point where people see it and go, well, OK, it's right at the doors of Leinster House, so we need to take it seriously then, and we need to put it in a safe...
Do you feel you were taken, the threat to you was taken seriously before?
To be fair to An Garda Síochána, I think they took it seriously, but I don't think the public per se did. I think they were very good. I had very good public support insofar. They were sympathetic that this mother... was worried about her child and she shouldn't have to. But I don't think they understood the issue there in terms of the growing group that was the far right and how they were getting public support through different things and through people ignoring the fact that they're growing. Like the articles I've read this weekend and this week, some people were very much saying, listen, it was just a group of 200. They were a bit like Father Ted. They didn't know what they were doing. They're just nutters. But the thing is, if you are someone who's been threatened by them, it doesn't feel like that they're just a small group. And there are many that have been threatened by them in terms of the refugees, migrants, people who speak out in relation to gender. All that, all those groups have been threatened by them for years now. And my question is, how do we try to look at it instead of just putting a safety zone around politicians at Leinster House?
Yeah.
Because they're not the ones, like my husband is in there, and I can tell you they're not necessarily the ones that need it at the moment. So,
okay. Brenda, you were writing about this in the Mail the other day, and you were suggesting that this is kind of part of a narrative, and that it's a lot of it has been actually fed by the far left.
By both sides, by extremes of both sides, really, and not even
and of course
the extremes.
They do say they meet at the end of the horseshoe.
It is a horseshoe. It's not a continuum. I think that there is very little between the extremes of both ends. Actually, I see Helen McEntee quoted as saying something similar today. She said there's been a notable deterioration in the tone and content of some increasingly personalised commentary on political and public affairs, particularly on social media, but not necessarily confined to social media. She said we saw this aggression and coarseness evident in the disturbing scenes outside Leinster House. And I mean, you know, it's not just confined to the far left or the far right, because, you know, it has become commonplace now to cast aspersions on politicians' agendas and their motives. And, well, you're the party of the landlord and you're the party of the elite, the wealthy elite. And while that may not, well, you can't, you know, blame it entirely for the scenes we saw this week, but it doesn't exactly diffuse the kind of inchoate anger that gave rise to that.
I think when we, and this is no disrespect to Brenda, it's just when we start going, well, it's because of the far left that we have the far right, we're actually not looking at how the far right has started. There will always be that argument of, oh, if we didn't have people talking about this from the left side, the right side. I can tell you, quite honestly, the far left, or whatever we're calling the left, have never said to me that my child is a mongrel, have never said that she need my 3-year-old at the time should be masturbated over by refugees. They have never ever said to me that they will come find her at school.
How do you know that? How do you know that? Because, how do you know who these people are? Have you seen their membership cards?
Let's not forget that it was the far left that held the then Taoiseach in a car
for 2.5 hours with menaces about 10 years ago.
Okay.
That was the far left.
You know, but what, Brenda, be that as it may, I think there's an element of that these are not the exact two same things. I think we have to give Hazel her lived experience.
But my point
that's
also
absolutely,
is
that is appalling and disgusting. Let's acknowledge that.
But let's not acknowledge the far left either.
But Brenda, the more you say it's one or another, one against another, you start to erode what is the actual problem.
But the actual problem
here right now is that there is a growing group from the far right that is getting support or funding and other resources from abroad, trying to cause this chaos that we've seen, not just in the US, that's a bigger example, but you've seen it in Sweden, where they repackage this kind of fascism into something that's more palatable and try to present it to the general public. And up to a couple of weeks ago, a lot of the general public was absorbing that disinformation and lies from the far right and actually lapping it up. It's only this week when they see gallows and they see effigies that they go, oh, maybe that's a bit too far now, kind of way. So this is where we need to start looking at intelligence gathering and going, how do we sort this problem? But how do we
I think the Gardaí seem to be monitoring a lot of people. And I think there's 20 in particular that the Gardaí are constantly on top of. Ronan.
Yeah, so these groups were outside our hospital as well a couple of weeks ago. You know, the doctors are murderers, doctors are in the hands of Big Pharma. And interestingly, we had the so-called, I don't like this terminology, first of all, left or right. I think it's lazy post-World War II politics, means nothing to the youth of today. You know, for example, I was reading one of the so-called far right in the papers claimed that he used to be known as the hard left. As I drove into the hospital, the left who were on the right and the hard right who were on the left of the entrance to the hospital were roaring abuse to one another. You know, vulnerable people coming through the hospital sick, listening to all this noise and kerfuffle.
And what was their beef on this occasion?
Oh, do you know what? It was very hard to understand what the protests were about at all, actually. It was just a scattergun of everything. But this is the interesting point. So I was reading a good article in the Times.
Gary Murphy, is it?
Yeah, and also a great quote by a man by the name of David Robert Grimes, who actually characterises these groups, hard left or hard right. Well, there's three main things: disenfranchisement, or a feeling of disenfranchisement, distrust of society, and discontent. And rather than having a debate, and I think it's important that we have a debate about policing, but we also need to have a debate about what is the root of these things that is fueling this. Because it doesn't matter whether it's hard centre. It doesn't really matter. The fact that these people feel this way and will react in this way because they feel this way is the thing that needs to be teased out. Now, Gary Murphy, in his excellent piece, does give this very useful insight. He says at the heart of this, and I would agree with him in this movement where he's quoting from Zadie Smith's book, The Fraud, or he's using it as an allegory to what's going on. He says at the heart of this is people fearing change and having this nostalgic view of from where they came from themselves was more homogenous, was a perfect state, and that, you know, that the change represents some sort of nudge to that and affects their feeling and makes them feel discontent and disenfranchisement. And I think that's a core issue, actually, as to how do we give people a sense of belonging to the new Ireland. And, you know, for example, we can do it through sport. Rugby was a great example last night in Paris, how people feel belonging to our sport, to our society. Aviva was the same thing. So we do need to find channels like that where we kind of challenge the sense of a proper sense of belonging, not a false one, proper sense of belonging.
A new story to tell. What is a country or a nation but a people rallied around a story? Okay, we'll take a break there. My panel staying with us, Professor Ronan Collins, Brenda Power, Hazel Chu and Daniel Murray.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Our panel still with us, Brenda Power, Hazel Chu, Daniel Murray and Professor Ronan Collins. Daniel, the threat to the budget from the health overspend, Hugh O'Connell's story in the Sunday Indo, and then the Mail on Sunday, 14 billion hole in National Rail and Road Plan. I guess they're all part of a kind of a seamless robe of worries.
They are threats to the budget that are going to grow in the years ahead. But the immediate one being pointed out by Hugh O'Connell on the front page of the Sunday Independent today, that the health budget is facing possibly more than a billion in an overspend for this year. And it's something that we've known there'd be some level of an overspend in health this year for a while. And we know it every...
You've been at this for the last year, haven't you?
We have about...
In terms of how the spending is working and the communications on it and all that.
Yeah, we've almost done the same run of stories this year that we were able to do at the same time last year about the health budget. And look, the health budget has always been a budget that has overrun and has needed to be bailed out. But what's different is that the scale of increase in the health budget in recent years has been extraordinary. And despite
that... The 4 or 5 billion put in for COVID has stayed there.
It has
right?
effectively stayed there. It hasn't stayed as COVID spending, but the health budget has its base has increased dramatically initially for COVID spending, but much of that became baked into the base in different ways. But despite that, we're still facing record overspend in the health budget. Last year was over a billion. This year facing over a billion again. And we got letters between Pascal Donoghue and Stephen Donnelly earlier this year discussing exactly this point. And Pascal Donoghue said to Donnelly that it represented an unprecedented risk to the health budget, not only because of the risk to the health budget itself, but because the scale of the health budget, I actually think it's now the largest budget in the state. It's overtaken social welfare. So an overrun in the health budget threatens the fiscal stability of other departments, because if you have to spend on health, you can't spend on other things. Your pot shrinks.
The giveaways in the budget, let's be frank, that's what people are wondering about. Does this affect the giveaways in the budget, yeah?
It probably doesn't, because of the scale of surplus that we're expecting this year. I mean, they're thinking about 12 billion they're going to have in surpluses. But again, it's about the future and the stability of the public finances. Like at the moment, there's an argument that our public finances are built on sand, because the corporate tax receipts, there's alarm bells going off around them. Are they going to stick around? Could they decrease in the years ahead? And they're being described as windfall by both of the two senior economic
and
ministers.
No, they would argue that they are saving most of it and investing most of it.
Well, they're going to start doing that now, but they've also continued to spend record budgets in the last couple of years, budgets of over 14, 15 billion. It started with COVID-19, but emergency has begot emergency. You know, we've run into the Ukrainian refugee crisis. That's requiring extraordinary spending. We have the cost of living packages that are also going to come this year again, came last year, will come this year again. So it's an extraordinary level of spending. There's other spending pressures coming down the line as well. The health budget is one of them. Demographic change. We've heard about the pensions time bomb. Climate change and the cost of climate action. And so all of these are piling up. And as John Lee highlights on the front page of the Irish Mail on Sunday today as well, there's also a hole in our capital budget in the years ahead, much of which has to do with delivering climate action, public transport projects and otherwise. And a lot of this has to do with inflation.
Okay, so that's a chew. cheery the whole situation. Brenda, there's a very wise guy I know, and he says the first thing you need when you're thinking about anything is an exit strategy, right? Before you embark on anything. We embark on these big spending things. We never have an exit strategy for how to get out of the spending on the other side.
Like. Do nothing about them. Apparently now the Metro North, the essential airport link.
This is the front page of the Mail story.
2036 now. Looks like how long we're going to be waiting for, for a metro.
And we're talking about this since when?
The
turn of the century, roughly.
At least, the Mail has a timeline. And it's really depressing. I mean, 2005, it says, the underground project was first recommended. I mean, even to be commencing talking about a rail link to the airport in 2005 was a disgrace.
Would I be right in saying that? Is it our general experience, all of us, that whatever kind of woe-begotten city you arrive in at the airport, there generally seems to be countries that are much less flush than us. There's generally a train going into town, isn't there?
Yeah, there pretty much always is. And I was looking at, I think I said this before, the advice to visitors from Dublin airports. So there's lots of ways to get into town. You can get a bus, you can get a taxi, you can go by car, you can cycle or walk. From Dublin Airport, you can cycle, you can walk. I mean, you're reduced to telling people they can walk into town, you have a pretty poor excuse for a public transport system.
Hazel, before we do that, Daniel, will you just explain to us in a nutshell your page one story in the Business Post about the EU looking for another 1.5 billion off us?
Yes, so the European Union's budget needs to increase for a range of reasons, not least of all the war in Ukraine and money that they are contributing to that. So for the EU budget to increase, it needs to get more money from member states. And there's a couple of innovative ways that have been proposed to do this. One of them is for member states to pay an additional contribution into the budget, but for this to be calculated on the basis of corporate profits in a country. So in Ireland, because of the astronomical scale of our corporate profits from multinationals, that would mean that we would be paying really an outsized portion.
Are they picking on us deliberately here? Like, is this
That's the suspicion behind the scenes, is that, you know, the French and the Germans have been coming after our corporate taxes for many years now. And we're only just through the OECD corporate tax process, which has seen us sign up to a global 15% corporate tax rate, which we'll be implementing from next year for very large multinationals. But there is the sense that possibly we'll be fighting another proxy war on the corporate profits front again.
Okay, I think all of our mothers would have a thing to say about this. They're just jealous. That's what our mothers would tell us.
Michael McGrath's right. Like Germany, and Daniel pointed to Germany there. Germany has a huge advantage drawing foreign firms because of their size and demographic location. Should they give us some of their money that they earn from these strategic positioning? I don't see them doing that. So why should it be us? So
okay. Hazel, briefly, before I have to go to another break, but can you tell me briefly about Ellie Donnelly's story in the Business Post? You wanted to say something about Kellogg's now are highlighting the housing shortage.
Yeah,
challenge.
I was looking at that and I kind of didn't laugh, but I was slightly amused because I get where Kellogg's is coming from and they are absolutely right. We are in a housing crisis and we need to build and we need to continue to build and form new innovations. And one of the things we're doing actually in City Council is regenerating kind of the commercial and above shop living, which we should have done ages ago. But I look at Kellogg's and I kind of go, as we talk about multinationals and how much they get from us, is that why aren't day building. Like if you look at the Capri's and the Guinnesses back in the day, there were workers' houses. Like half of Crumlin was built by Guinness. And Google was looking and kind of eyeing up more the built to rent, but they are looking into ways. And even Marriott Hotel was looking at converting the back of part of their hotel for staff. Why can't multinationals be more involved in it?
I think Kellogg have a history in this. Didn't the old man Kellogg who founded it had a big kind of a health cult going, didn't he, where people lived in and everything? So
Not that. I hear you.
All right, I need to take a break. Ronan Collins, Brenda Purr, Hazel Chew and Daniel Murray staying with us.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Okay, a panel still with us, Ronan Collins, Brenda Power, Hazel Chew and Daniel Murray. Guys, there's two things I want to do quickly here, so let's be brief. Brenda Power, you are thinking that people should be buying their wedding dresses in the supermarket, according to the Mail on Sunday.
Yes, this is a fantastic story. If you look at page 3 of the Mail, they have a picture of Michelle Dockery from Downton Abbey getting married in a €100,000 dress, £100,000 dress. A few pages on, apparently Sainsbury's is beginning to stock 50 quid wedding dresses. And, you know, Brendan, I don't know about you, but I suspect that most men and a lot of women who've ever been to a wedding came away with the impression that the bride's dress was kind of white and it was lovely and she looked fantastic.
Yeah, and it's in a box somewhere in everyone's house.
It's never
going
to be worn again. 50 euro, 60 euro, they're predicting that there will be a surge of women crossing the border to buy this. Sound gorgeous.
Yeah,
Carol Knox and spaghetti straps. Sound beautiful.
Still buy into all this nonsense, spending this kind of money on
it. In fairness, because Bernardo's has a used kind of wedding dress shop in Dunleary that does really well, and a lot of people I know getting married are actually just buying
it
online.
Did you spend 50 quid or 100 grand?
I did not. I spent 420 quid, and that was thanks to Kira in Paris Court that got me a dress off the sale rack that no one wanted. And that's the thing. I ended up reusing it after.
I think if I get married again or renew my vows, I'll be renting.
Well, you'd prefer to a recycled. You'd be worried where a 50 quid dress comes from, like, and how that's produced. But you'd be.
Stop spoiling it for everyone. Now, before we go, the probably the most important story in the papers today has been identified by Ronan Collins. And Ronan, Colin McGuirk in the Mail on Sunday is telling us that Cork is actually the cradle of civilization.
I think this is just crucial, really. I mean, you and I have long believed it, obviously, to get the jingoism out. We've long believed this, but now we've actually scientific proof. Like, but a serious point, I suppose. Fascinating archaeological site at Cork Harbour. You know, 500 years plus older than Newgrange. You know, many thousands of years older than the pyramids. It's a fascinating discovery of an early farm settlement down in Cork, the true cradle of civilization.
Okay. So you would be claiming Kinsale, presumably, was where it all began.
I think your further digs will probably ascertain that they sailed out of Kinsale and around Roach's Point and into Cork Harbour, yes.
Okay, Daniel, briefly before we go, Luke O'Neill is writing about eco-friendly funerals today.
Yeah, we can always rely on Luke O'Neill for these kind of macabre stories. So this is an alternative to cremation. It's called aquamation, and it's where your body is immersed in a mixture of warm water and chemical called alkali. Your flesh is turned to liquid except for your bones, which are crushed up and given to your loved ones. So this is meant to be an environmentally friendly alternative to cremation, but it wouldn't be up my street.
I think I saw something like that happen in Breaking Bad and it did not end well.
Hazel, is cremation very environmentally unfriendly? Are you against this kind of thing?
I honestly don't know how environmentally friendly it is, cremation, so I apologise in advance for not knowing that part. But I look at the proposal there, and I like Luke, but it just, for some people, that might be a bit of a step too far. So for me, I think I'll just be sticking to being buried 6 foot under the ground.
I think for it to reduce emissions.
Yeah,
anyway.
And added back to the earth from whence you
exactly.
came.
Exactly. It's
and
a whole
maybe a tree
like,
planted and everything. Now,
cycle.
We should say, I know, you're saying I like Luke, but I won't go for this. I don't think Luke is actively promoting the business or anything. And he's just saying this could be an option.
He's working for big aqua.
Ronan, are a lot of people going for alternative methods of disposal after they die these days?
I think there's an increase in interest, and you'll probably see an increase in interest as well in people going for kind of the permafrost kind of option.
And wait for the technology to catch
technology,
up back to life.
The one thing I'd be interested about is how the wastewater will be treated from this process. We do have a big problem with wastewater in this country, and our rivers are in a shocking state. I was looking actually how much environmental issues were covered in the paper. Very few.
I know.
Which is amazing given the report that less than 10% of our rivers are in a pristine state.
Yeah, look at Loch Lay, look at
okay,
all the
and on that bombshell, we have to let it go. Professor Ronan Collins, Brenda Power of the Daily Mail and the Sunday Times, Hazel Chew, Green Party councillor, and Daniel Murray, Paul Carr with the Business Post. Thank you all very much.